Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. For those of you who don't already know, Luxman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Luxman and Loretta Brennan Luxman, Luxman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. And my name is Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray. Well, folks, another busy week here at Luxman Ireland House, and actually this week we are getting ready for a visit by the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, Uachtaráin na hÉireann. He's going to come to the NYU campus on Tuesday evening and deliver a lecture on ecology, society, and climate. I'm going to give you the exact title of it here now, and we hope that on a later This Irish American Life that we will be able to share that with you. It's called On Responding to the Interacting Crises of Our Times, Ecology, Economy, and Society. This event is at capacity, but we do hope to share the audio with you later on, and we're really delighted that the President is taking time out of his busy schedule while he will be here in New York City to attend to us here at the campus at Washington Square. He is well known as a politician, an academic, a poet, and has had a really stellar career as a President of Ireland since he was first elected in 2011, believe it or not. He's on his second term. Now, on Tuesday evening, we have no less than the President of Ireland, but on Thursday evening we do have our regular programming. Our colleague here at NYU and someone who's studying in our master's program, Gina Marie Guadagnino. Gina's going to do a reading from her new book, The Parting Glass, a novel. You'll remember Gina was here earlier in the year to have a chat with us about that wonderful novel, and at 7 p.m. on Thursday evening, she will share her insights into the writing and research behind that with us, and we're really looking forward to that. If you'd like to find some information about that, please do go to our website. Now, one other thing to just have on your radar, Friday, October 4th isn't that far away, and that's when we'll have our next Blarney Star concert. We'll have Sean Quinn and Brendan Dolan here. Sean is from a very well-known Quinn family. His father was very well-known, Louis Quinn, and they've had an immense impact on the topography of Irish traditional music in America and in New York specifically. Now over about 60 years or so, he will be backed by the great Brendan Dolan, who's also from Irish American musical lineage here in the New York area as well. And that concert will take place at 8 p.m. and that's on Thursday, October 4th. And the fall semester is already flying by if I'm now talking about October already. Now, on this week's program, I'm delighted to share with you two interviews. The first is with somebody who should be a little bruised after last weekend, and I'm talking about the replay of the football final, and that is Donal O'Sullivan, Donny O'Sullivan, great Kerry footballer who was here with me to have a chat today, and we're delighted to have Donny on the programme. And going on from that, I'm going to share with you an interview I've conducted with Dr. Carl O'Hanlon. Carl is doing some really interesting research on the poetry that administrators, civil servants in the Irish state wrote in that generation after 1916. Desmond Fitzgerald is one example of the people he profiles in this research. So I'll go from Donal O'Sullivan and all things Gaelic football to Dr. Carl O'Hanlon. Enjoy, folks. I'm delighted to welcome to Glucksman Ireland House and to This Irish American Life, Mr. Donal O'Sullivan, Donny O'Sullivan, Fáilte Rash. Welcome back, Donny.
Good.
I had you on here before, actually, a number of years ago, but I'm delighted to have an opportunity to have a chat to you today on your visit to the United States. Yeah. How many years is it? Can you tell me about your first visits to the United States? And, of course, people, anyone who knows anything about Kerry football and the GA in general will know who you are. But for the uninitiated listening to our program, will you tell us a little bit about, I suppose, the role of the GAA in your life and in your coming to the United States over many years?
Yeah, it goes way back to, I think the first year was 1966, and that was my first visit to the United States, even though I was a US citizen from birth through my parents. And it was such a thrill to get the opportunity to travel. It was Gaelic football, to participate in what was known as the Carnival Cushing Games in Gaelic Park in Chicago. I suppose it was almost like going to the moon that time.
And you were playing for Kerry at the time?
Kerry at the time, and you select a group, maybe 10 players from different counties.
And that was the senior team?
Yeah, that was senior players, yes. Our team was playing with the county teams, and it was organized in behalf of the Cushing Missions in South America, fundraisers in Gaelic Park. John Kerry O'Donnell was the man behind that at that stage. And what I recall as well, it was sponsored by Rheingold Beer.
Oh, wow.
I haven't seen them around of late.
So, but it was to Chicago then you first came?
No.
Oh, it was here to New York.
Gaelic Park, and then Chicago also. Some of you went to Boston as well.
So when you came there that time, Donny, in the 1966, I mean, there were a lot of Irish here.
Yeah, Gaelic Park was the meeting place, as was the weekends, and it was almost community-based. It was where, I think, if you were an immigrant, you would go to meet people on Sundays, especially weekends. And it's looking back, it served a very useful purpose. People who might, for contacts, or meet friends, maybe to get word of a job somewhere, and also entertainment, because of food and dancers. And not only games in Gaelic Park, there was also restaurants and so forth, and it was a great meeting place that time.
So there probably were thousands of those things in the at that time.
Yeah,
Gaelic Park would have been packed.
Yeah, there would have been a good few thousand. I recall, I think, 69, they played the National League final there, Kerry, New York, and both Sundays the place was packed, really packed.
Wow. And New York would have been fielding very strong teams, presumably.
Yeah, New York had very little compete that time. And I think a part of that as well, the New York players that time, this was their home. They had immigrated from Ireland. They were living here for many years, and this was it. They had a great spirit and so forth. Some of them are still around, and they were as good as most teams in Ireland.
And Donny, so you mentioned you were an American citizen then.
Yeah.
What was that? Your parents had been here?
Yeah, my parents were here also, and grandparents. It was only in later years I found out that my one grandfather was born here, and some. Yeah, it was. I think they, as was explaining how you'd explain it, they probably were immigrated. Maybe somebody's born here, and then there's a recession here, and they go back to Ireland.
Yeah.
But my parents were here for many years, and a few generations back also, as far as I know.
So when you were a child growing up and teenager and everything, America loomed large in terms of the psyche of, or like, had your relatives here and things like that?
Yeah, a whole lot of relatives in Boston, especially Boston, a few in New York as well.
Right.
And in both sides of the family. So I suppose it was almost the story of Ireland, particularly the west of Ireland.
Uh-huh.
And in many ways, it's I suppose it was a sad story, because there's a lot of the, as you know well, the Irish word for an exile, an immigrant, is Jori. And it comes from the word, as you know, from tear, the shedding of tears. And I think I recall now, what was it? The story by Liam O'Flaherty was a going into exile. I think that sums it up pretty well.
Yeah, and in those years, Donny, you know, we kind of take for granted now the instant contact we can have with home and stuff. People didn't have that then. I mean, it was beginning to change in terms of flights and stuff, but it wasn't anything like we have today.
And when people came, see, it was back again to Peg Sayers in the book on but Peg Sayers wrote anyhow, but Peg was the name of the book, that they spoke of immigration, Vise Kosulish and Moss. It was like death, because for the parents and the older people, they might never see their children again. That was it.
Yeah, the American wake.
American wake, and there was good reason for it. The wake started off as a party and finishing up as a wake.
So you had come from a background, Donny, where the GAA was a real kind of institution in your social life, and you came to a New York where, you know, when you think about it in terms of an institution for the immigrants, the GAA was very important, right? In terms of connecting people from home, connecting people from particular counties, keeping up the traditions.
It was huge. Really big, and I think that was a huge influence, and so important to have it for people for getting people together, for bonding, for helping one another. And it was it was amateur and classless, and we call it Gaelic as well. Gaelic, classless, amateur. So it was, it was a huge influence and a huge value to the immigrants, not only here in Boston, San Francisco, and Chicago, and it was needed. Something like it was needed, and in that sphere, I think in that area, the GAA did untold good that has not been, I think, written down or appreciated for the Irish community and for Irish people here.
So, when you came in 1966, which is 53 years ago. It started a relationship, though, between you and the United States that you've maintained over time, connecting you in terms of interest in education and sport and stuff like that. Tell us about how important, or the role that your connection to America has played in what you've been doing over the decades, Donny.
Well, I think it went from there at that time that previous to that, I had been in touch or somebody in St. John's University about coming out there to do some study, graduate study at St. John's University, and that was in that trip there I met I think in Gaelic Park he came to see the game was Sam Fanning, Dr. Sam Fanning, who's a professor in St. John's University,
and he was very interested in all things Irish.
Things Irish, in hurling from Moneygall and Tipperary originally. He spent many years out here. A fine scholar and a history professor there.
So did you kind of forge that connection there?
Yeah, and it was ongoing before that, but he brought me out to St. John's University, and it was arranged that I could come out there the following year.
67?
67, yeah. And no, I came out, September 66, actually. It was very quick. It didn't take that long.
Okay. And so you studied out there then in St. John's?
I got one of these. I'm so lucky and thankful for a fellowship to. You taught some bit and you got free tuition.
Okay.
And enough to live on.
So then you played football out here as well?
I played a bit out here with
the Kerry team?
Yeah. And a bit with New York for the year I was there, over the year. And I played the mid-attempts at kicking American football.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And so what were you studying, Donny?
I wanted to do history, but I was directed into educational psychology.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh. So it was, a whole new, or was it a... Was it a very different approach and system here in comparison to Ireland?
Huge, because it was a kind of a shock to the system as well, the semester system where you had to get down to straight away, whereas in Ireland at that time, you could take it nice and handy for September and October before you do anything.
Right.
But so it was a kind of a baptism of fire to go in and straight away you got to get producing something.
And did you maintain that connection with Sam Fanning while you were there and
all
everything?
And afterwards also.
Wow.
He was great. He was a wonderful person. And he taught a year at University College Dublin as well. He himself, I think, was Dudley Edwards. Prior to that, they were quite good friends.
Right.
But I don't think that later in the 60s they parted ways regarding revisionism and all the rest.
Right.
And I'm not surprised at that.
So then you returned to Ireland then after that year, don't you?
Yeah, came back to Ireland. Yeah, I was supposed to stay on, all right. I had to do some more study, or PhD. I had enough of education, I think, at that stage.
Right.
And I had an opportunity, whether it would work out or not, of playing American, of kicking with American football. And with the local team here, the Jets, the New York Jets.
Oh, wow.
Who can I recall from there? He was the manager, a very fine individual, a man I thought, I'm sure he's long gone, Weeby Eubank.
Right.
Who gave me very good advice and was very helpful. And I think someone was guiding me, because instead of doing that, I went back to Ireland.
So, and did you found like American football easy enough after?
Well, I was only kicking.
Yeah.
So it was a different game. It was just, that's all it consisted of, not the physique or the physical contact. You'd avoid it, or most
right.
of it.
Yeah.
It sounded very glamorous starting off, but then you begin to put two and two together and think about it.
Yeah.
And the one thing is, was the, I missed, as the year went on, not so much the county football at home, but the clubs playing with your own, the people you grew up with and who went to school with. And I think that was the thing I miss most about it.
Really?
And then it was a team game. You were part of a team. If you were kicking out here, you were not part of the team.
Right.
And there was also the consideration, which was very real, that you might make it at all.
Yeah.
You could be in the scrap heap after a year.
Yeah. And even probably back then, it was probably probably not as competitive as it might be today, but probably, much more competitive than what we would have had in Ireland in any way, shape or form, sporting-wise.
Well, it was professional, and I think professional is more of a rat race than that. The Gaelic games, they were competitive enough, but at least it was amateur.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's more enjoyment from playing amateur sport, where everybody is more or less equal.
Did you have, at that time, Donny, in the late 60s, did you have a lot of contact with the Irish community here in New York in terms of the organizations and newspapers and music and things like that? Like, what did you have much of a vantage point, or did you look at the Irish immigrants who were here and say, that's not really my cup of tea, in terms of kind of being connected to Ireland, but being away from it,
Well, I think the immigrants here, the people I know, are friends. Some of them are still alive and some of them are still friends.
Right.
I enjoyed that experience. It was great meeting them, and most of them were wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still there. Mick Moynan is still up in Woodlawn.
Right.
The business there, I'm glad that he's left, and there's some more also. Many more of them have gone. I think there's a man who played here, Tom Fury, is still to the good.
Right.
And many, many more. Sean O'Shea, I hope he's still well out in Queens.
Right.
But they were great people. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. And we've more or less kept in touch with many of them. over the years.
And when you did go home, Donny, you've, like, throughout the years, though, really maintained strong kind of connection to not only New York, but to California and things like that.
Yeah, well, with California then, I suppose it was, there were games starting in San Francisco. And it shows you how, I went to San Francisco that year on a visit, and it was the time of the hippies.
You went in the 60s?
Yeah, well, I had relatives there at that time. And it shows you how cut off we were. I didn't even know what it was about at the time or understand it.
Wow.
All along Market Street. And then we had many a visit to San Francisco, and it stayed, and it's such a beautiful place. And the same way, same people, the same Irish people that are there, many of them are gone now. And I later had spent a long time in San Diego at the university, well, teaching summer school there and things. And I would go back to the GA again. Nearly everybody we knew, or I knew, close friends and so forth, came through the GA.
Right.
People we met and came across and so forth.
You seem to be someone who, like, through those networks, though, Donny, you were... Well, it connected you to people from all different parts of Ireland. I know the Kerry contingent is big and strong in terms of being connected and stuff like that. But it kind of, you seem to have navigated that landscape in a way that kind of puts you in touch with people from all over Ireland.
Oh, yeah. So that's, and that's so important.
Yeah.
We're all the sort of little difference.
Yeah.
And that has still lasted, that if you go up, especially up, say, maybe up to, we didn't play many games up in six counties, but so many friends there all the time in County Derry and down, people who beat us maybe many times, but that's not important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the friendships lasted and the contacts, and it has been, I'm grateful for and thankful at this age to have had those experiences.
We're chatting about the GAA and, you know, it's in the aftermath of an All-Ireland, and I'm not going to rub salt in the Kerry wounds, but, you know, really to see the interest and support that the likes of an All-Ireland final kind of gets out of people, is it surprising to you in 2019 that at least on some levels, the GAA is such an important part of Irish life still?
It is, yeah. And it's I think the enjoyment I got over the past few weeks are not so much enjoyment, more appreciation of the Kerry flags out everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You think it was dormant for some time and it just come back everywhere. And not begrudging Dublin, because I think it's so important, because of the population, that Dublin are doing well. Maybe they're doing too well now. But I don't think there's any... Kerry are going to be back as well, because they have a lot of young players and young teams. And even looking at Cork, I suppose if I was younger, I wouldn't be saying this at all, I wouldn't appreciate it, that Cork went down in football there for a while, and that was a big loss to Kerry, because opposition.
Right. You think it had an impact?
Well, yeah. It was not good to see Cork going down in football, but they're on the way back again, as they had the under-20s and the minors this year. So that's encouraging as well.
So whenever, like Kerry, in particular for you, when Kerry are playing, it's like tense for you to watch it?
It is,
Do you like to go to watch it live? No.
I would like to go, if you would... I haven't been to the final for some time, and it is tense, of course. It's easier on the players, because when it starts, you're relaxed, so you have to get involved in the game if you're watching it, and you get older especially. I don't think it's good for the health, good for the heart.
But and obviously you wouldn't get as kind of invested in it if Kerry weren't playing.
No. You think beforehand I'm going to be like a stoic, sit down and just enjoy this.
Yeah.
And then one finds oneself, you know, sitting out on the edge of the chair and, you know, wheeling things on and blaming players and so forth.
Yeah.
And you say, it's time to get sense, but that's no good.
It's easy to get caught up in it, though, I know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Could I ask you, Donny, what do you think that, I mean, this is a kind of an unfair question in a way, do you think that Dublin will continue to dominate over the next few years, or like these younger teams coming up are going to kind of chip at them a little bit more?
I don't think so. There's only so much in every human body, and this is an exceptional group.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd be more worried about is not Dublin winning, because the population is so big, it's huge there, and they're so well developed, which is a great thing. The clubs are so strong.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the GAA lost Dublin, if football wasn't strong in Dublin or weak, it would be a huge loss. It would be very hard to counteract it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be more worried about the counties with the smaller populations and not developing, and they cannot compete. And the second worry I have as an old man at this stage is the emphasis on professionalism, because it's no longer, I think it's very difficult to say at the moment that the GAA is an amateur organization, and there's certainly a divide. It's elitist for certain players,
mm-hmm.
and that's not a good thing,
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't founded on that. And you look at the ideals of the association, it was really founded for the ordinary people to play, and the emphasis now on, I think, finance and money and structures and competing and fields and so forth. What are going to the small clubs and the weaker counties, what's going to happen to them? And there's another thing I have a bee in a bonnet about, is people doing examinations at university level. Can they can, I know they're succeeding to do that in Dublin, but if you're doing some difficult course of study and 4 or 5 years engineering medicine, can you, or is it possible to be able to study, achieve your goal, and still compete at the highest level in football or hurling? And because there's such emphasis on this training, you've got to be there, the all-powerful person is the manager,
mm-hmm.
and they're calling the shots. I think it's a problem for the GAA. I think this payment for managers, which is not, we don't know how much it is or where it's going, but it's there, how they're going to handle that. Or will it become a full-time professional association, or a professional game? And are the resources there, or is the country big enough
to support that? Yeah.
And will the same people support the clubs, the volunteerism, number of people involved with clubs, volunteer, only for all of us that played, some people volunteered, fields, taking to games, looking, all without pay,
mm-hmm.
without even expenses. They kept us going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I hope it will, because it was a magnificent, a wonderful organisation.
Yeah, I mean, and I suppose some of those issues are symptomatic of kind of wider kind
society,
of society,
yeah,
and
of the
pressures.
Yeah, where society is going.
Yeah.
And we're back at thing, just, I don't know why the finals have been shifted to August, not September. I thought always that September was a brand name for the GAA. You had the hurling final, the football final, first or third Sundays generally. Now that has, they've seeded that into August. Why? I don't know. A number of years ago at a baseball game in San Diego, there was a friend of mine there who was very involved with the governor or something. Anyhow, we had very good tickets. Not that I could follow it very well, the baseball, but there was a man doing television work, a very strong, powerful man physically, and he called him over because they knew one another, and they began talking about the baseball game, and then he said about, threw down Gaelic football. And this man, who's Eastern European background, born in America, he said, I never saw it, hurling or football, but I always knew when the finals were on, because our pastor went to Ireland every September.
Oh, wow.
So he was on, down almost on the Mexican border talking about that. Never saw a game, but he knew the finals were on in September.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Donny, it's lovely to have an opportunity to chat to you. You've, you know, brought out the spirit of the GAA and your outlook on it and shared it with many people in this country for over 5 decades now. And I hope that you can keep continuing to do that and spread. You're kind of modest, but be the kind of ambassador you are for it, because it. I think the GAA and Ireland need people like you to do that, even though you don't kind of see it that way. So I'm publicly getting an opportunity to go on the record in that regard. And thanks for sitting down with me today. It's lovely to have an opportunity to chat to you. I've often chats with you informally, but to have one here through this medium for you to share some of your thoughts, gur míle maith agat.
Tá fáilte, agus beag láir le cúna bhí. I'd like as well maybe to say what Glucksman House, you and Joe Lee and Marion Casey again, their interest. And the first time I was here, what surprised me was the interest he had, not so much in the games per se, or you know who won that, or not, but the association, the value of it, and the importance, and the ethos.
Yeah,
so and long may it last.
Yeah, I think Donny, you know, goes back to what you talked about there in terms of now Jolie would know who won what, especially when Kerry was involved going back for decades.
Yeah.
Marion and I would be less good at that aspect of it, but we all, and our current director would be of this school as well, in terms of recognising the absolute centrality of that institution for generations of Irish immigrants. And, you know, Donny, it gives me so much pleasure the last few Sunday mornings to be bringing my son, 7 years of age, out to Sunnyside Gardens to play, you know, hurling and football, to see that being passed down and the continuing their tradition and how it brings people together behind something as positive in terms of sportsmanship and collegiality, you know, on the field, which some of the best of the GAA players like yourself have exemplified.
Yeah.
It's a very positive thing, you know.
And by playing it, not what we did for the GAA, what it did for us.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
I've conducted many oral histories over the years, Donny, where I've often conducted interviews with people where the first thing they did when they got to this country was go to Gaelic Park, either to get to actually play or to just find people from home or to get a lead on an apartment or to get a job. You know, it was a really important way of bringing people together. Maybe, you know, with the trailing off in immigration is performing a slightly different role over time, and I guess we'll have to see how it adapts over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's encouraging to see some young people picking it up. But I don't, you know, because we don't have the numbers here, it won't be like what it was like in the 60s for you.
Yeah, it won't be.
And on one level, that's a good thing, because it means that people aren't leaving Ireland, at least for here.
Yeah.
It makes you think about places like Australia or, you know, Dubai and these places in recent years where there was a lot of Irish immigration and some of the first institutions you see coming together around Gaelic games.
But even further afield, say, they have clubs in different cities now. They may not last, but it's still a great bond. I think of San Diego, especially, you know, that it's still, the club was only formed there probably in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And the bond that has created.
Yeah.
And just a small little anecdote, that the first time I went to the University of San Diego to visit it there, and I had such great days there later, the first man I met was, who died sadly only a few months ago, Malachy Rafferty.
Right.
From Galway. A wonderful, wonderful man.
Wow.
And that was the first contact, and the only thing we had in common was hurling and football.
Right.
Even though he had played rugby as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
We won't talk about that.
Yeah, but he was the GA was his first
love.
And that was my first introduction to, and that's what say the value, what the GA does was the contacts, the friendships,
yeah,
and so forth,
the connections. Well, I could chat to you all day, don't I? Arish Gurmila Mahagut, August Bector Asherish or Bow Lacoon of Day.
Yeah, Gurmila Mahagut, August Tasulagung Mayok, Tawny Shawninish.
Okay,
Tawny
Gurmah.
Every day is a plus.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks again, Donny.
Okay.
I'm delighted to welcome to this Irish American Life, and indeed to Luxembourg Ireland House and to New York for the first time, Dr. Carl O'Hanlon, who is currently doing some research on, I would say, a well-known figure in Irish history, but maybe somebody we know less about than one might anticipate. I don't know whether I phrase that correctly, if you know what I mean, Carl. I'm speaking about Desmond Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. Desmond Fitzgerald, I suppose many younger people will associate his son, Garrett Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
That's right. He was Garrett's father,
yes,
right?
That's
his
correct.
Direct yeah. Parent. He was in the GPO in 1916, and he held successive ministries and other portfolios from 1919 onwards. He had, I suppose, actually, Carl Garrett actually came to Luxembourg Ireland House a lot, and it sounds like his father had a wide range of interests, possibly like Gareth did. First of all, welcome to Luxembourg Ireland House. It's wonderful to have an opportunity to chat to you on an American leg of your research, I suppose, for your monograph your monograph is not specifically on Garrett or on Desmond Fitzgerald itself.
So the monograph is on poets, modernist poets particularly, who were involved in the creation and the administration of the Irish state.
Okay.
So, I mean, I suppose the Ireland that the poets imagined, terrible and gay, is a kind of, has entered into Irish studies, and it's a well-worn track. But what I was interested in looking at was poets who maybe held some kind of either political or bureaucratic office, be it as a diplomat in the case of Dennis Devlin, another figure I look at, or a civil servant in the Department of Finance like Thomas Kinsella. So it goes as far up as perhaps Thomas Kinsella. And Desmond Fitzgerald was one of the early figures that I locked on that I knew I wanted to look at in that respect.
So he wrote poetry?
Yes. His poetry really doesn't go beyond, he started to write again in the 1930s, but effectively most of what he wrote was written before 1918, 1919, at which stage he was the director of propaganda in the First Irish Republic. And he started to write really in London with the Imagist group. And indeed it was Desmond Fitzgerald who introduced Ezra Pound, along with Florence Farr, to the Tour Eiffel meetings, which were a kind of offshoot of a more genteel and staid group of poets, the Poets Club, that met under the group of great Victorian bastions of the poetic establishment, like Sir Henry Newbolt. This more rowdy group met in Percy Street and off Tottenham Court Road and wanted to revolutionise poetry. So I'm looking at Desmond Fitzgerald as a kind of early revolutionist in two senses, I suppose, in terms of throwing off the pentameter, along with F.S. Flint and T.E. Hume and indeed Pound and other imagists in 1910s London. But then later, of course, a revolutionary in the GPO in 1916 and successive ministries in the Irish Free State.
So did this evolve from your doctoral research, Carl?
It's completely different.
Okay.
I actually studied an English poet, and I would say, I use that word advisedly, a poet who Heaney described his indomitable English-ry.
Yeah.
Riffing on Yeats, Geoffrey Hill. And I would say the nucleus of this project came out of that study. Hill was deeply interested in Ezra Pound, And he was particularly interested in what he described as modernist poetry's yearning for a sense of identity between saying and doing, this idea of making things happen, to coin a phrase from Auden, that modernist poetry wanted to bring action, political action, into some kind of connection with the word and the deed hand in hand. And so as I thought of this, as I muddled through this in Hill, I started to read a little bit more of Pound, and I started to see Desmond Fitzgerald crop up quite a lot, and a lot more than anyone seems to have talked about in Pound's largely unpublished material, it's fair to say. But a figure that he wanted a memoir written of in the 1950s, thought him a really crucial and important figure who had been neglected by both literary and political history at that stage. So the nucleus of the project from my PhD, I suppose, was this interest in modernism and poets as unacknowledged legislators, but in this case also actual legislators, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Desmond Fitzgerald, a real key player in the Free State government, and really to look at those connections between effective action and a kind of complicated politics with modernism, if you look at Yeats, T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound and the kind of the political ramifications of their poetries. It's complex and in some ways quite scary, I think it's fair to say.
How is it to be, like, now delving into stuff that's bringing you back to Ireland geographically and imaginatively and intellectually?
Such an interesting question, because I think really, as a young man growing up in Belfast, I always had a sense of travel. I mean, I did a Fulbright in the States in Washington, D.C. for 2 years. And beyond that, I'd been in France, and I sort of travelled around a bit and thought I was well settled in England. And Brexit happened. And I think with a lot of my peers, people my age, who've been on a kind of similar trajectory of post-Good Friday Agreement consensus and a kind of sense of a very confident sense of an identity that's complex and mature and so on, there was a kind of shock that this precious and hard-fought identity was in some ways thrown into crisis by this moment, and still seems to be. And so I suppose I had a re-reckoning with Irish literature as well, that this sense of kind of being the globe-trotting cosmopolitan and going out into the world was great, and it was very important for me as we say, as a young scholar from Belfast. But I think really to go back into it has been to deepen my sense of understanding and see that the complexity was already there. I didn't need to escape out of it, that it wasn't monolithic and it wasn't simple. It was really there in the literature, and you can see that in someone like Fitzgerald, who is arguing the case for European literature in Sinn Féin meetings as early as 1916-17, writes the first review of T.S. Eliot in a Republican magazine in 1918, the first review of this great modernist poet in a Sinn Féin magazine in 1917. So I suppose it was about, deepening a sense of the complexity of an Irish identity that was already there, and that perhaps because of political circumstances I had maybe sidestepped or evaded in some ways.
Can I ask you, Carl, would I be fair in saying, and I suppose I'm jumping on this a bit wearing my historian's hat, but this project is much more historically based, perhaps, or maybe the Hill one, you did a lot of his biographical, kind of that would involve historical research, presumably, mm-hmm. a little bit. But to what extent is this more inter-transdisciplinary or kind of pushing the boundaries for you in terms of like how you come to the topic?
Oh, very much. I mean, I've had to kind of retrain as an historian on the spot in some ways and get to grips with not just private papers, which are much more easy, I think, for a literary historian to come to grips with, but the vast amount of state documents mm-hmm. in various national archives, and that has been challenging in some ways. At the same time, I'm heartened by discoveries that I've made in this project that, for me, really radically intervene in what we know about major historical events in Ireland, including the Irish Civil War, the extent to which diplomatic, secret diplomatic missions that no one's really talked about were conducted by Yeats, particularly. There's a particular omission in early 1923 that I discovered that I don't think an Irish Civil War historian necessarily would have discovered, because it's the interdisciplinary nature of the research has led me there, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it's been a challenge, but it's also been a wonderful experience where wearing two hats has allowed me in some ways to I think, make real discoveries.
So in that journey, it's literally brought you here to the United States. Yes. So for our listeners, you know, and it's always great to have an opportunity to speak to a scholar coming from Europe, you know, from Ireland or from the UK, to hear about, like, which kinds of archives, which archives are relevant to your research on this topic.
So
here in the States.
Here in the States, the Beinecke obviously is a kind of modernist jewel in the crown, and I spent a week there last week, looking at particularly Ezra Pound's papers, and there's a lot more Irish material there than you might think. He gave, for instance, from Mussolini's Italy, a broadcast on Sinn Féin, in which he tried to incite Irish listeners into kind of stabbing England in the back and throwing off the shackles of neutrality and so on. So there are these moments in Ezra Pound's literary papers where Ireland crops up again and again and again, and even in early journalism that he wrote in 1919, Sinn Féin's part of what he's interested in a kind of eclectic magazine called The New Age that a lot of these figures published in, that was a sort of social credit, was the big economic plank of that particular journal. So the Beinecke's been really important, and here closer to home in the New York Public Library, I've just come from there. I mean, the Yeats and Lady Gregory papers are just a tremendous resource, but also again minor figures like Edward Marsh, who was an English civil servant, an undersecretary of the colony of the Colonial Office, and a secretary to Winston Churchill and subsequent secretaries for the so-called colonies, who was a literary man as well, and had correspondence with a great number of these figures, including Yeats, was heavily involved with Yeats in trying to get the Hugh Lane pictures returned to Ireland. So there are a number of kind of minor figures in the New York Public Library that people don't know as much about, perhaps. I think I probably would be bringing coals to Newcastle if I said Patrick and Mary Collum here in New York. Mm-hmm. But again, there are papers there that I don't know that they've necessarily received the kind of celebration that they should for the connections that they make in a kind of transatlantic sense between Ireland and particularly the US, publishing a lot of the poets of the 1916 rising in American poetry journals for the first time, and their papers are in the New York Public Library.
And I think from an Irish perspective, you know, based on some of the digging we've done here, wearing the historian's hat, you know, they were pretty widely read, some of these people, you know, in a non-Irish milieu, in a way that I sometimes think, you know, coming out of Ireland, where we think of them sometimes as being more parochial or, you know, more limited in terms of their That's impact right. than they actually were.
Yeah. I mean, to give an example of this that's cropped up in the research, Desmond Fitzgerald edited the Irish Bulletin, which was the magazine that really countered what they saw as British propaganda. And his means of distributing it was actually through poetic circles. It was through contacts that he'd made as an imagist poet in London. He first went over to London in, I think, around October 1919. I think that's the right date. And he begins to make contact first with French journalists through his imagist contacts. And from there, I mean, the amount of contacts that he then subsequently made are astonishing. So he was distributing the Irish Bulletin to as far afield as Buenos Aires, and a Dutch newspaper man harboured, according to one account, harboured Desmond Fitzgerald and some other Republican figures in his attic in Golders Green, this journalist from Holland. So there's a kind of network that's being made there in that respect, and it's somewhat similar to the literary network. That's what I'm finding when I look at these things. The overlap between, say, Yeats's circles in his gentlemen's clubs in London are often a real mixture of kind of what we might call dilettantish amateur poets and literary men. I mean, Churchill wrote poetry as well. You know, men of office and men of state. Men is the kind of problem of this. Just as I say that word, I realise it's one of the kind of problems that I found is after the initial revolutionary period, and this is kind of, I suppose, well-worn territory, a lot of these modernist poets, unlike Countess Markowitz and figures that we can associate with the revolution, a lot of them are really men by the time the Irish Free State kicks in, and I've had to work really hard to dig up examples of Irish women poets who were working in these kind of ministerial or bureaucratic roles.
Partly just because of how, you know, how unattainable certain positions were as females in this era, presumably.
I think that's true. I mean, I think there was really an implicit ban on it certainly in the kind of big civil service offices of the Free State. The secretary of the Department for External Affairs, now Foreign Affairs, Joe Walsh, was a kind of radically conservative former Jesuit who ruled the department like it was a Jesuit novitiate in one account. So I think Mary McInshee is one of the earliest examples of someone, Maura McInshee, sorry, who's one of the earliest examples of a poet who was also a diplomat.
But I venture to say, am I correct in thinking, Carol, it probably wouldn't have been that different outside of Ireland and other incomparable positions, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was
really that era on a global scale.
Yeah,
like that.
I think that's true.
Which is not to diminish your attempt to kind of grapple with that. You know?
I think the case of maybe exclusions in magazines is maybe less so in America, certainly, because you do have these really important editors of modernist magazines like Harriet Munro,
right,
and so on. But certainly in government office, I think that's fair to say. And archives is another problem. It's just kind of the archive is a different problem. I'm aware of things that were going on. So, for instance, the Women's Writers Club was involved with it wasn't part of the state apparatus as such, but it was very much involved with civil service members, a quasi-governmental organisation called the League of Nations Society, and it was run by Blanid Salkeld, who was a modernist poet, and it was a real pressure group. They protested the constitution in 1937 and wanted more explicit recognition of women in the constitution. So there are examples of it, but they don't have archives, these individuals, and they're scattered, and where they're kind of collected is very different to how we access, say, Yeats or Ezra Pound or whoever. So that's kind of part of the problem too.
Well, it's a fascinating project, Carl, and I hope that when you have it finished, that we'll have an opportunity to kind of hear more about your conclusions, or it sounds like you've a fairly good handle on it, but the journey will bring you, and there'll be more insights to come, I think.
Yes, I think so. I think really it is a case of consolidating now and trying to draw out this connection that I have a kind of implicit sense of, this connection between I suppose the way the poet legislates, the poet as legislator, the unacknowledged legislator that Shelley described, but in this case, an acknowledged legislator.
It's a great example of something that's, crossing the disciplinary boundary, I think, in a really nimble way that's allowing you kind of spot things that someone only wearing kind of a literary hat, or someone only looking at it from a historical lens purely, it's drawing out a richness, I imagine, that is difficult to imagine doing it another way.
I think so. I hope so. I mean, to give an example of where I think that it works as well, if the kind of difficulty of modernist poetry and the opacity of it, in Ireland, so many writers, novelists, were banned in the 30s because they were making, like Kate O'Brien, making these kind of transgressive statements. Very seldom do poets get banned, and it's something to do with being able to read the difficulty of the material as a poetic form. Mm. So someone like Denis Devlin, for instance, is writing translating French Resistance poetry while he's involved in serious negotiations with the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, about Ireland staying out of the war, effectively. And it's these kind of moments of tension that I'm interested in as well. And I think really poetry's form, it's something quite different than a novel. And it certainly is curious that so few poets were banned or blacklisted during that period.
It's really, yeah, it's fascinating when you think about it in that way, because you're right. I mean, even as someone kind of who's removed from a lot of knowledge on that topic, but, you know, you do really hear of a banning of a poet in that era. Listen, Carl, thanks for coming in to share with us your insights. I guess on the off chance there's anyone out there listening who thinks they know of an archive or somebody who might be of interest in this journey, please don't be a stranger to us here at Luxman Ireland House here at New York University. And I'm grateful to Cormac O'Malley, a great supporter of us here at Luxman Ireland House and a long-term board member and former president of our board. Of course, he's very interested in these topics and delighted for the introduction. Lovely to meet you, Carl. And thank you for coming to this Irish-American Life to have a chat to us. And we look forward to having you on again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Knighton-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to this Irish American Life. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. If you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Levon Henry, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. And our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.